Imagine it. You're all set up to sign a lease and then learn you've been denied because of bad credit. And then you discover somebody has taken out thousands of dollars of loans in your name. According to the U.S. Trade Commission, identity theft is the most common form of consumer fraud and affects 11 million people. From registering for government benefits, obtaining cell phones, to racking up thousands in consumer debts, criminals can be ingenious. But there are things you can do to help protect yourself and make regaining control over your identity easier. I'm Susan Wilson, and today on Central Standard, we'll be looking at financial identity and your credit score and ways to manage both. The Cash Money crew has answers just after the news. It can all start with a stolen wallet or password, a computer virus, or documents we just don't take time to shred. The next thing we know, our credit card is maxed out and our bank account is empty. Today, we're talking about identity theft, one of the fastest growing crimes in the United States. But there's not just financial identity fraud to worry about. Criminals can use our name to obtain government benefits, medical care, and even clear their own names during an investigation. Later in the show, we'll talk about what you should know about the art of good credit. Yes, it's that time again to talk with our financial experts, the Cash Money crew. This is Central Standard, and I'm Susan Wilson. Joining me today is Alec Petrovic of Petrovic Services, Lucas Butchell from KHC Wealth Management, and David Jackson from Waddell & Reed. They represent the Local Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Susan.
Glad to be back.
Glad to have you back, the Cash Money crew. I'd like to poke our listeners a little bit before we get started. Kansas City, have you ever been a victim of identity fraud? And how did it happen? And what did you do about it? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us, centralstandard@kcur.org. So, guys, identity theft is on everyone's mind these days, especially with the breach recently at Target, also Neiman Marcus. How common is this kind of breach these days? And how likely is it that, you know, the hackers can actually steal information that they can harvest that will affect us?
Well, it's becoming more and more common all the time now because, you know, so many people are doing things online and it makes it a little bit easier to get your information. And then plus, you know, everybody's using their credit cards. So I think it's becoming pretty pretty regular occurrence these days.
It really is. And I think it's an interesting crime that the thieves have a pretty low risk of being caught and then prosecuted. So I think it's an attractive way to steal, and I think that's leading to more prevalence.
So how big is this problem, really, as we put this in perspective?
Well, I think it's the fastest growing crime in the U.S., and there's more than 12 million victims every single year. So I think you see that, and those numbers have continued to climb. I was reading a little bit of information before coming on, and you know, that number has crept up from 10 to 11, now over 12. I read 12.7 million in 2013. So it's fast growing, and you know, I think cases like this Target case, which is massive, just has a crescendoing effect on that.
So how often do you encounter identity theft in your practices?
Well, Susan, this is Alex. I actually was hacked in our business account here recently, and luckily we were doing reconciling our bank accounts almost immediately after it happened, so we had very little damage, and the local bank covered the losses. But it can happen. I mean, and we have no idea where it was taken from. It was our debit card. So, I mean, I think everybody can talk about somebody they know that this has happened to. And sometimes it's very little damage or small inconvenience, or other times it can last for a long, long time.
Now, you talked about recovering what was stolen. When your identity is stolen, who does hold the liability? Is it the victim or the businesses or some combination of both? How is that determined?
It's kind of the legal piece of it is some combination of both in most cases. One of the key things is that you report the theft or the activity right away. If you find out information and then you sit on it, the longer you sit on it, the more responsibility you would have. And in almost all cases, the financial institutions, if you report it right away, either have very limited or even no recourse goes to or responsibility goes to the individual. However, if you don't deal with it right away and they find out about it, then you're potentially on the hook for everything.
Yeah, so it is up to the individual to be proactive, you know, as soon as they recognize that something's happened. And sometimes you can spend a lot of time trying to clean the mess up, you know.
And we're okay, Alex.
Well, one addition in our family, we my wife debit card with a local bank, she got a new debit card in the mail, and we thought maybe it's just the updating, but it also had a little information on it that said, due to the recent Target situation. So apparently she'd used that card at Target previously, and this local bank, I guess, being proactive because we didn't see any damage done, but we were given a new debit card. And that in itself is kind of inconvenient because you got to be sure you got the right card, be sure you open your mail timely. But so this is a huge thing. But
well, it seems like local banks are getting much more proactive. I know they called me about a couple months ago asking me had I made a $1,200 transaction in Brazil.
Yeah.
And, of course, I wasn't in Brazil, and they caught it. But it seems like the fraud departments of banks now are a lot more proactive in monitoring this kind of thing, right?
It's kind of comforting to know, too. I've had that happen several occasions to me where the credit card company has contacted me and asked me if I was somewhere. And I do tend to travel. So sometimes it is a legitimate credit card purchase, but there have been times where somebody's tried to use my information.
Now, in your experience, are there any particular populations that tend to get most affected by identity theft? I hear about seniors being vulnerable, especially, or is it pretty much equal opportunity?
I think it's probably across the board. You know, hackers or thieves, you know, certainly looking for people with the deepest pockets, but many of these people have no idea whether it's, you know, they're phishing on, fake emails that you get. They're just out there trolling. And I don't think, but I would say that the most vulnerable is going to be, you know, the elderly population because they're a little less, you know, on guard.
Yeah, and it's exactly right because when they're out there doing that phishing, you know, those expeditions, and they say, well, give us your information and we will provide you this. You know, the elderly are a little bit more susceptible to fall for that kind of thing.
Yeah, they may not think that by giving their information it could lead to a problem.
Right. You know, I come back to I have a friend of my mom's was so convinced for about 10 years that she had won the sweepstakes and was going to be getting some millions of dollars. And, you know, she was an elderly person just knowing that she was going to become rich someday.
Yes.
I think the distribution is fairly even across different age groups, but I think two that are more susceptible would be the senior population for some of the reasons already mentioned. And then one that goes under discussed, I think, is with children. So kids are online all the time now, and I think tend to be fairly naive in some of these techniques. Phishing has been mentioned or just trying to get you to provide information online. And I think making sure you're watching your kids and educating them about things that are unsafe. And you, I mean, you get a lot of press about, you know, talking to strangers and those things. But I think the financial piece of it is also really important and a growing problem as kids become more connected earlier.
Yeah, because kids are online, you know, playing games, doing a lot of different things. And I can see where that could be a problem. Now not as big as maybe children or seniors, but I also hear that there's a growing subcategory of identity theft by relatives where relatives will take out credit in a dead relative's name or even a living relative.
Yeah.
I have a sister that it's been probably 10 years ago, but met a fellow that was a thief. And he was a pro. And he got to know her, started dating her, and then in the meantime, all he was doing was secretly taking her credit cards, getting all the information, and then soon after they broke up, and then all of a sudden, you know, he had gone out and created all these different identities and credits with her. So, you're right. People that you know or people that you let in your home, it's just widespread. It could be anybody.
So you have to be careful the company you keep, the moral of that story. Now, you have mentioned the word phishing a couple of times. For listeners who may not know, what is phishing and how can we recognize it?
Phishing is generally an email. It's where somebody reaches out to you and poses as someone else. So, for example, a lot of the common stuff is posing as your bank or some institution that you do business with, saying, "Hey, we're updating our records, and we want you to click on this link and provide your information." And then they oftentimes will ask for social security numbers, credit card information, or, "Hey, please verify your debit card number because we need to make sure our records are up to date." What they're doing is they send you to a fake website, and then they're tricking you into providing your information, oftentimes very personal and key information that they can then use to turn around and steal your identity.
And some of those fake websites are so convincing too. You would have a really tough time unless you knew telling the fake website from the legit one.
So your advice, though, is if you're going to do that kind of business, go to the legitimate website itself. Or call the company itself.
Well, if you're being solicited, you should be on guard. You know, if you're making the outreach yourself, you're probably going to the right website. But if somebody's coming to you, you know, asking you to hit this link to go to this website, there may be something a little bit shaky about that.
Now, as another form of phishing, I know occasionally I'll get one of those emails from a friend who's stranded in Australia with no money and send, you know, big bucks immediately. Is that another type of phishing scam?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's just another version where they're trying to, you know, kind of draw on that emotion, and you know, you want to help out a friend, and of course, you know, probably calling them or you know, trying to find out if they really were even traveling is important before you just give them your credit card number.
I hate to bring up another family story because you guys are going to wonder about my family. But
all right, Alex.
My father's in his early 90s, and not long ago, he got a call from a gentleman that sounded very authentic and claimed to be my son. And said, "I'm in jail and I need some money." And my father basically said he didn't have any money to give him. But he never told us for several months because he was embarrassed to talk about the story. And I said, "No, Dad, Alex is not in jail." My son is named Alex as well. He's not in jail and he doesn't need the money. So just hang up on those people.
Wow, I've seen that in emails. I didn't know they were actually making phone calls doing that too. That's interesting.
Well, they had his name too. So it's like...
Well, I guess there's so much information out there on the public domain now about us, which is a worry when you think about some of these identity thieves and how they're using, you know, some of the information to track back to other information.
I think Lucas made a really good point about children because, for the most part, children don't really have assets to lose, but they have that identity to lose. And what people are doing is getting those Social Security numbers and doing everything from filing tax returns and getting refunds, number one. So they're getting that from the government, but using a child's ID. And most of the time, we don't think about checking our child IDs.
Right.
So you should, you know, go to the credit companies and use your children's Social Security number and see if there's any credit reports on those children. And you would know that there probably shouldn't be. But if there are, you know, you should do that occasionally as well to see what's just be proactive.
And, you know, that's a good tip because most people wouldn't even think about doing that. They're thinking, well, my child doesn't have credit, so there's no point in doing that. So that's a really good tip. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Susan Wilson. Our guest today, Alec Petrovic of Petrovic Services, Lucas Butchell from KHC Wealth Management, and David Jackson from Waddell & Reed, and they represent the local Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. We're discussing the growing problem of identity theft, how to protect yourself, and the best things you can do if it happens to you. Kansas City, how difficult was it for you to clear your name after identity theft, and what did you learn that you can share? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So you were talking about filing tax returns, but I also have heard that people are using someone else's identity to get medical care, let's say if they needed a big expensive operation, or even to clear their name in some investigatory activities. Have you heard of those things happening to people?
Absolutely. I think the tax return piece is becoming more common. So what they'll do is they'll basically file a tax return early for you. And, you know, if you're like most folks, you're waiting towards April or even after that. And then there's been times I've had multiple clients that have had this happen to them, that they go to file their tax return and the return's already been filed and their refund has already been paid by the IRS. And so then there's a big process, of course, to deal with that and get things rectified. But, you know, that's something that's becoming you hear about it a lot more. You know, there's other types of things that are definitely coming down the pike. And it doesn't surprise me at all on the medical piece that, you know, as expensive as that is, you know, trying to falsify that and get the activity. And as soon as you walk out the door, you know, there's no identifying information for them to come back at somebody that's getting that activity.
So that bill is going nowhere, in other words.
Right. And then the person that they stole the information for, of course, is the one that gets left with the problem of dealing with it, right? So you can probably go in and prove that, yeah, that it wasn't you that had that procedure. But that's probably after they've already filed, you know, claims against your credit, trying to collect. And you know, then, of course, the credit agencies, you know, there's a process to go through to fix that piece. And so that's really where the identity theft is the biggest issue, is it's the time and this the sheer amount of time and red tape you have to go through to get things cleaned up. That's the most underestimated thing about this. The financial repercussions we can talk about, and sometimes they can be serious, but most of the time, those, as long as you're reporting it properly, get cleaned up. The biggest issue is the amount of time and, you know, mailings and follow up and all the things you have to do to get your credit right.
Yeah, you think about one of the things that's going on now is most people do online banking. And back in the old days, remember how everybody would go through their checkbook and, you know, go line by line and try to balance their account to the penny? Well, with things being online and, you know, it's so easy to just, you get the statement of, it looks good to me, and, you know, just move on. So people aren't as nearly as vigilant as they used to be in checking all the purchases that show up on their bank account now. And, you know, so sometimes you end up paying for stuff that you had no idea you even purchased because you don't look at your statements.
So the moral of that story is you better be scrutinizing your bank and credit card statements pretty carefully then.
Absolutely.
Well, when you talk about getting out of this mess, I see advertised all the time various insurance, quote-unquote insurance plans you can buy to protect yourself from identity theft. Should it happen, then they take over and try to do a lot of the paperwork to get that cleared. What about those products? Do they work, or do you have to clear your identity the old-fashioned way?
Well, first off, I wouldn't rely on them to get you out of the trouble. And I'm not saying don't purchase those protections, but if something happens, or even if it doesn't, don't stop doing your own due diligence. Mm-hmm. Don't rely on the third party, although they could help you. They can maybe pay some of the losses and whatnot, but it in no way relieves you of doing your own hard work.
And actually, right now, we have a caller, Kathy, who has a question about this very thing. Good morning, Kathy. You have a question about LifeLock.
Yes, good morning. I have, for the past 6 or 7 months, I subscribed to a service called LifeLock, and they alert me to anytime I'm opening a credit card or anytime any organization is trying to check my credit, and I'll get an email from them. It's quite expensive, and I'm just not really sure that I want to continue because of the expense, although it is kind of nice to have that somebody's watching out for me, you know?
When you say expensive, how much are we talking here?
$250 per person.
Per year?
Yes.
Okay. So what are your thoughts about a service like this? Are they helpful? Are they worth the money?
You know, I think they definitely can be helpful. I'm actually using one right now because we had our some information on a credit card of ours taken, and the bank provided it for a year, and so I get those exact emails where they tell you, you know, you can set up the alerts, but basically, you know, you get alerted when people are looking into your credit or your balances go up or down. And I find it's a nice monitoring thing, and it's good to know on most of that information. However, you know, I think the you know, for $250 a year, let's say, You know, I think the value really needs to be determined by the individual. So if that's something that's really important to you and you're going to choose not to do some of the other monitoring techniques like checking your bank statements, pulling your credit reports, you know, a couple of times a year to make sure things look good, that's an alternative. And then the cost benefit, you just have to decide, you know, whether it's worth it. I think you can do a good job of monitoring things without paying for a service like that, but they do make it pretty convenient. You get emails and just letting you know about activity.
Aren't there services, though, like that if you were hit with an identity theft situation? They notify the various creditors, and they take some additional steps beyond just the monitoring. Aren't there some services like that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are some people will. There's usually an insurance attached to it as well, you know, I think those services can be helpful. My personal view on those, though, is that a lot of times aren't worth the money, just because the big cleanup mess still belongs to you, and they can have a call center where that you can call in and get advice on what to do and how to the steps you go through. That information is pretty available, though, if you just do a little bit of research. The biggest piece and the biggest time drain is you know, just kind of dealing with it, sending all the letters, calling the credit agencies and the banks to get things cleaned up.
So let's walk us through that process, gentlemen. What does that look like? You've been hit with identity theft, and you're sitting there and you're saying, where should I begin?
Well, it depends on, you know, what type of situation it is. But if you see where you've been charged for something that you didn't purchase, you know, you have to start with contacting the credit card company or whoever. And one of the things we recommend in a lot of cases with major purchases, don't use the debit card, but use the credit card, because the credit card will actually, you have a little bit more protection than you do from the debit card.
But how easy is it these days? You know, when identity theft first started happening, I heard stories where people were very frustrated in trying to clean up their credit because, you know, people had never heard of it. You know, they thought the people themselves might be scamming them. Is it easier now for people who've been hit with an identity theft issue to clear their names than it ever has been before, or still difficult?
I think it's still difficult. I think there's clearly a much more an awareness of the problem that's out there, and the banks and institutions are keenly aware of it. So I think from that piece, the stigma has left somewhat, because it's a pretty common issue. But I think the steps that you take in the cleanup can still be tedious. So the first thing you should do is call the financial institution that you're dealing with, kind of where you discover it. The next thing is to I always recommend putting on a credit alert with the credit agency. So that's contacting one of the three credit agencies, and they share information, so they'll kind of pass the alert on to the other two, and that kind of puts them on higher alert to ask more questions if somebody's trying to open a new account in your name. So those are the top two things. A lot of times it still makes sense to file a police report. You know, I think the one thing there is you have to have limited expectations about what the police are going to do with you. They're not going to invest this crime unless it's just a huge case.
But the main value of that, right, is to just get it on the record that your identity was stolen, right?
Exactly. And I've experienced it personally, but also had friends that were frustrated because the police didn't do anything about it. And it really is just getting that documentation that, hey, I recognize the problem. I called the authorities about it, but I would expect it to stop there in most cases.
Let's take a caller. Arlene from Midtown has a question. Arlene, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much, Susan. And it's a friend of mine who has a really hard time to get out of an identity theft through a Capital One card. He's in his late 20s, and I think this happened maybe when he was mid-20s. And what it's teaching me is really monitor my statement that I get from my credit card company and never deal with Capital One. They have a lawyer. They've made this guy lose work 8 days to go down once a month for 8 months, going to court, never getting his say, the lawyer always bringing up trumped-up charges, you haven't done this, you haven't done that, and his next date is in February, and every time I hear Capital One advertised, what's in your wallet, I say, damn straight, it sure isn't your Capital One card.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, wow, Arlene. I guess you would feel that way after that kind of experience. Is this common for credit card companies to really vigorously defend themselves against someone who's alleged that they've been the victim of identity theft?
I'll be honest with you. I haven't heard stories like that. Most of the time, the credit card companies are very willing to kind of stop the charge, change a credit card number, send you a new credit card, and it usually stops there. I'd be interested to know the full set of circumstances on what was going on there. It seemed like maybe a more involved case, but she did touch on one thing that is often a concern is, missing work because you're having to deal with this stuff. So,
right. It is a hassle. It is a hassle. I am cleaning it up.
I think it sounds like, involved in a court case and trying to, kind of get that cleaned up. There may have been, more to that story than we heard on that short clip.
Well, I think do you think, as you pointed out before, the longer you, because she mentioned it reinforced the importance of looking at your statements. Do you think this could be a case where maybe he just didn't notice these transactions until months later and then tried to go back and say it was identity theft?
That could very well be.
Could make it more understand the severity.
Right, because my experience with the credit card company, much like Lucas, the credit card company has been really cooperative and helpful as far as helping me clean things up.
This is such an interesting in our business, financial planning. But in the investment world as well, we have some really huge players that this affects. For example, most of us have shopped on eBay. I've just warming up to Amazon.com. And if they can't get this credit thing worked out to where consumers are comfortable with going online, then it's going to be a huge shift in the way people do business, back to cash, maybe checks. Mm-hmm. But there is a huge risk that these large companies that are taking share away from, the bricks and mortar stores, they're listening because this affects their bottom line so much because Amazon does with PayPal. And I've gotten PayPal emails saying, well, we need to update your PayPal information. Immediately, even if it's real, I don't care because I can call PayPal. I am no longer replying to those kind. But there's huge stakes in this, and the credit card companies as well. So they're going to do their best, I'm sure, to try to help combat this. But it still starts at home.
Well, I imagine the difficulty for companies, though, is every time they have a fix for one of these potential identity theft problems or computer security issues, there's another criminal out there who outsmarts them and comes up with yet another something.
Yeah, we haven't talked about firewalls on your computer or Wi-Fi hotspots in those. But, you when you buy your computer, oftentimes you get 30 days or something. And a tendency is not to want to pay for that firewall, that Norton or whoever you're using. But you're very foolish not to keep those things up to date and to be sure. And that's what's with people that aren't real computer literate, too. It's a hassle of remembering to do these things and to look at the newest updates from your Microsoft, data. But it's really important, or you should be leery of using those things.
Well, that's a nice segue into something that I really want to touch on because we want to prevent becoming victims. So what are the main things that you prevent, that you recommend to people to prevent this? David, what do you tell people to avoid becoming
It's not so much as avoiding because we have to live our lives. We're going to be making purchases. You just have to be vigilant, because if they try hard enough, there are ways that they can get to your information. You need to be paying attention. If something doesn't look right, follow up on it.
Now, Alex, you mentioned Wi-Fi and what are the risks there? Because people now are going to different places using the Wi-Fi and maybe even making purchases.
Sure.
What do they need to be aware of?
Well, when you go into a place like Starbucks or Panera that provide these spots to try to attract people to come in and sit down and eat and buy a cup of coffee, and the problem is that you're not sure how well they're protected, and they can be hacked relatively easy compared to your own network at home, let's say. So the rule of thumb is don't access personal accounts where you have identifying information about you, like your name, your address, your social. Don't go to those, when you go to those accounts or make purchases over, wherever, Amazon, wherever, in those Wi-Fi spots.
Now, I know the other tip that is often given has to do with passwords. But, now passwords has become a major hassle for people. You have one for every account. You can't remember them half the time.
Right.
So what do you recommend to people? I mean, they're a necessary evil, But they're very important in terms of avoiding identity theft, I would imagine.
Yep. One of the new things that have come out here in the last several years is these kind of secure password vaults that you'll have on your computer. And now most of them have apps for your iPad or your cell phones. And what they are is they're an encrypted place to hold and keep those passwords. So the common thing that folks do is they pick one password for everything because it's easy to remember, right, or some variation of that. And the nice thing about this password vault is it kind of gets rid of that excuse, right? So you have all your passwords available to you on the same device you're accessing, these different websites. And then you just have to have one core password to get in there, make sure it's a good, hard, safe one. But then you can get in there and that file is encrypted on your computer or device that makes it a lot harder to get into. I've had some amazing stories. I had one client that actually had their password file in just a Microsoft Word document on the desktop of his laptop, and it said passwords.
Oh no!
And you can click on it and have access to his whole life. So if he'd ever lost that computer and somebody was able to get in, or even just was able to hack into his computer, he would have been in a world of hurt. Some folks will still have them just written out, leave them on their desk, and you don't think about that. But when you have folks
guilty,
in your home, these secure password vaults are really something that I recommend to folks, and making sure you get a good one you got good encryption is important. And you can do a little bit of research and find out on kind of what are the top rated ones. But that's something I suggest to a lot of folks as a way to protect yourself.
I'm going to have to talk to you about after the show. So I need to learn about that myself.
I think in addition, the password, Lucas is right on that recommendations. But your cell phone, your Kindle, your iPad, all of those ought to have passwords to them as well. It's inconvenient because when they shut down, then you got to do it again. But just know that if you lose that, The other thing is in our business, we exchange a lot of information with different professionals, whether it's a CPA or an estate planner. And be sure that, first off, that your financial professional is using encrypted emails.
So should you just ask them?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, that should be automatic. And I'm interested to know what my colleagues here, but oftentimes if it's too difficult for the client to open encrypted, and some older clients it is,
right?
The fax machine, at least at this point,
yeah, at least we
hasn't been hacked.
Safe.
Wow.
So we send stuff very often. We say, go to the library and fax that stuff to us. So instead of people at home might be able to scan it and then email it, boy, as soon as you do, you got all that ID of your personal information that's on there. So faxing can be a workaround, but be sure you ask, is this encrypted?
Let's take a caller. Alberta from Kansas City, Missouri, you have a comment or a question. Good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you very much. More description of an identity theft that happened in our family several years ago. We didn't get any mail for 2 days, which is very rare because you always get junk mail. So I called the post office and went over, and they said, oh, you've stopped your mail. I said, no, I didn't. That's how they managed to latch on to my husband's identity. How that worked, I don't know, but I know I filed a report with the local police, and I spent a lot of time talking to fraud investigators with the Bank of America on the West Coast, and I don't know which bank it was in Wilmington, Delaware. And finally, I asked one of them, why would somebody want to do this? Because it wasn't a credit card. And they said, oh, usually it's because they want a nice, clean identity for drug money laundering.
Hmm.
So there you go.
So they actually stole Alberta's husband's mail. In this case,
no, they didn't steal our. I don't think they stole.
Oh, they stopped the mail and then got the mail that way.
I guess I never quite figured that out, but it was a good thing I did follow up on it. I'm sure you agree.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for that that comment, because I think that's a form of identity theft that people just wouldn't necessarily be looking out for. That someone puts a stop mail. And then, of course, in the mail, you have all these credit card offers and that sort of thing, which can be a problem, too.
Yeah, that's an interesting story. And that is a little bit more of an old-fashioned type of theft is stealing the mail, but it's still effective for the thieves that are trying to get your personal information.
Yes, I think there's so many ways these days. Well, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking about having a good credit score and how to maintain it. Central Standard returns in just a moment with the Cash Money Crew. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Susan Wilson, and we're hanging out this morning with the Cash Money Crew, Alex Petrovic, Lucas Butchell, and David Jackson. In our second segment, we'll be talking about the importance of credit scores and how to build and maintain your credit. Now, of course, we've known for a long time credit scores are important. Is there anything new on the credit score horizon that you've been working with lately?
Well, I guess the biggest thing that a lot of people aren't aware of is that if you're going for a job, they're checking your credit score too. So, you know, you may think, hey, the interview went great and my experience looks really good, but because I got laid off, I got behind on my bills, and so my credit score is really low. A company may decide not to hire you.
Now, what percentage of companies these days are actually using credit cards to in their hiring process?
Well, credit scores, you mean?
Credit scores. I'm sorry.
I know we when we hire a new individual, our back office does a credit check, and if there's anything interesting there at all, they will call us and discuss it. Of course, when you sign up for a job, you're basically giving the employer the opportunity to do that. So, no, I think it's very common and probably more common all the time.
Now, I understand that in any financial industry or any job where you're handling money, that pulling people's credit scores would be something that you would want to do for obvious reasons.
Right.
But what about a job that has nothing to do with money? Are employers checking credit as well?
They are, and I think it really goes to looking at the responsibility of the individual. So, you know, they're trying to get a gauge through the interview questions and you know, all the process that you go through. But one thing that the credit score gets used for a lot is you know, how responsible are you in terms of managing your personal finances? And studies will show that, you know, that kind of bleeds into other areas of life. So if you can't pay your bills on time, the chance that you're going to be somebody that misses work quite a bit and those things, I think employers are looking at that and saying, there's some commonality between those different personal trends.
Yeah, that is what makes it surprising because, as you mentioned, it used to be really just the financial industry that really paid a whole lot of attention to that because if you're going to be dealing with other people's money, we want to make sure that you have your own money together. But now just about all employers, all the big employers are checking that as part of the interview process.
Well, but are they a little bit more lenient, though, given that we're just coming out of a recession, as you mentioned? Good people were caught in the recession,
right,
got behind in their bills. Do they factor that in, or is that not something that's so much factored in anymore?
I would say that it depends on the employer. I know in our situation in the past, you know, we talked to the new potential employee and give them an opportunity to express what happened and how it happened, and we're certainly open to hearing that employee out if everything else looks good, because it's not uncommon, especially when we just went through the worst,
right,
economic condition or, you know, malaise in modern history.
So for those listeners who may have forgotten, what goes into a FICO score? Why don't you go over that a little bit for us today?
Yep, so there's five key components. The biggest one is payment history. That makes up 35% of the score. Accounts or amounts owed is 30%. Length of credit history is 15%. And then a couple of the smaller factors are the types of credit used and then new credit. So how much new credit do you have?
So when you think about your credit score, I know some people, there's a lot of misinformation out there. For example, I have friends say, I have too many credit cards. I'm going to start closing accounts. But then you hear that's not a good idea either, that the credit reporting bureau sees that as a negative when you're closing accounts. So,
well, possibly. But so here's part of the deal with that. One of the things that they look at on your score is what is your available credit? So if you have just one card and it has, let's just say, a $10,000 maximum limit on it, and you've already have on the hook for $9,000, so you only have $1,000 of available credit, that's frowned on. But if you have, say, four or five other cards that have a $10,000 limit on them that you haven't used at all and you have zero balances on those, then that improves your credit score. So it kind of depends on your particular situation.
Well, occasionally people do miss payments or they have things that happen in their lives that they run into a financial bump. What should people do if they miss a payment? Because the payment is missed, it'll be reflected on their report, right?
It's tough, but and I've had it happen to myself, where you forget about a payment somehow or another, is call the credit card company immediately. Tell them that the payment's coming. One of the issues currently is, though, that they can take that, you know, your payment right on the phone. But still, call them. Ask for, to remove the penalty. And oftentimes they will if you've had not bad history. You know, you can talk to them. And so they want to hear from you. So don't run from them. It's not going to help you.
Because that is a big mistake. People go into hiding when they should just address it front on and tell the credit card company, hey, your payment will be coming such and such a date, and then stay with that.
Now, another thing that often can affect your credit score is when you have charges that are in dispute. And that can get kind of ugly, and people can get pretty angry. So they just say, well, I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not paying it. What's your advice about that so that you can keep your credit clean while you're disputing a charge?
Yeah, that's always a tough situation, especially when you're getting at loggerheads with a financial institution that's then reporting on your credit. The best advice is to call and negotiate. And it kind of goes to David's point about not avoiding it, is calling and trying to discuss the situation and see if you can get through the arbitration process typically not have them report it until you've kind of got to the end of the resolution. Getting really stubborn or just kind of refusing to address the situation are probably the wrong things to do.
Now, in our last segment, we were talking about identity theft, and you were talking about the importance of monitoring, you know, your credit history. What's the best way to do that? Of course, there's offers out there that say, oh, pay $14.95, you know, a year and get your credit score. But people can do it other ways that are free, right?
Yeah, they should go to annualcreditreport.com and pull their do a request, and you'll get your credit report free of charge mailed to you. And then just go down the list and look at all the charges that show up on there. Are they legitimate or not? And if you see something that doesn't add up, you don't remember making that purchase or what have you, something that you dispute, then you need to be proactive. Write the credit card company. I typically advise people do things in writing so there is a paper trail on it. And say, you're disputing this.
So when there are bad reports on your credit, how common, though, is it once you go through the process of writing the letter and informing the Credit Reporting Bureau, how often do they take those off? What's the process for them deciding whether they take it off or not?
They'll perform an investigation, so they'll be contacting the lender, typically, that's reporting on the situation. And then, they get information from both the consumer and the lender try to get to the bottom of the situation. Generally, the first part of the process, though, is to contact the lender. So you'd be surprised at how common just simple reporting errors are, where they'll somebody will put information into a system will transpose a number on a Social Security number, and so somebody else's mispayment or situation will reflect on your credit report. And that's why it's important to go pull these reports free, by the way. You don't have to pay for some sort of monitoring service to get them and do that once a year and just kind of set that as a process that you do, just like changing the batteries in your smoke alarms or something like that. And that's a good way to monitor against identity theft as well. But kind of going through contacting the lender and trying to get that cleaned up and have them then report the update to the credit agencies. That's one thing you always want to ask. So if you go through a process and it's like, okay, we cleaned up a situation that was an error, always ask them, okay, I want you to report the updated information to all three credit bureaus.
Because if you don't ask them specifically to do that, they don't automatically? Is that it?
They do as common practice, but not always. And I always ask them to report at the next reporting time. Because not all lenders report every month. Sometimes they do it quarterly or at different intervals. And so I always want them to report it and report it right away.
So we really have two different institutions that we're involved with. You've got the FICO, the that reports the credit score, and then you got the credit bureaus that deal with, you know, your credit history. And then FICO takes that information. And I did a little research. I thought it was kind of interesting. FICO actually stands for Fair Isaac Company, a company that was founded in the early 50s by Earl Isaac, a mathematician, and Bill Fair, an engineer. And about 20 years ago, it became the standard. But to begin with, they created the system that they sold to individual companies to do their own credit reporting. And then they've masterfully, you know, became the record of choice. And I did look up their company. They're traded on the New York Stock Exchange, and I found it interesting.
That is very interesting. I never knew that.
That they have a credit-to-debt ratio. They have a debt-to-market capitalization of about 50, which by our industry standards would be pretty low for what that's worth.
So you've gone through a bad time. Maybe you've lost a job, a divorce. What's the easiest way? Well, it's never going to be easy to improve your score. What steps should people take?
Well, you just have to start by rebuilding that credit and showing a good faith ability to pay bills on time. So maybe you've been denied credit and you decide, okay, I'm going to get one of those gas cards, my favorite gas station, or a department store card that has a high interest, make a purchase, pay that off at the end of the month. That all of a sudden puts a good mark on you. So you start doing little things like that. It's not going to fix your credit overnight, but over time, you know, by showing a good history and good habits, your score does start building.
But aren't there situations where perhaps someone's credit is so bad it's hard to get any of those kind of cards? It's one of those chicken and egg situations. You can't get you can't build good credit if you don't have any credit, and no one will give you credit until. So what should people do?
Well, one, if you're really starting from scratch, you can actually go to and put up $500 to a credit card company. So it's secured. Nobody knows it's secured. But now you're rebuilding a credit with your own cash. But it shows up in the credit reports. And then, of course, you pay on time and pay it off and start over.
So we have a question from one of our listeners. How do I build credit responsibly for my children is the question that they're asking.
Yeah, I think it kind of goes piggybacks on Alex's comment there about kind of starting from scratch. So, you know, one thing that is a common thing is to get your kid a credit card, right, when they turn 18 so they can start showing a payment history. And I think that that is an effective way. You know, parents can co-sign and be a part of that to kind of effectively lend a little bit of their credit history to help the kid get started. It's also a great opportunity to teach kids about how to manage a credit card responsibly, making sure they're paying it off each month, understanding that it's just not a swipe and go. It's you have to pay that at the end of the month. So use it as a teaching opportunity and just be careful and not let the kids get out of control. Usually I suggest a really low credit limit when you're starting out. Another good way for folks that are just kids that are just getting launched is to, you know, if they're in a living situation at college, for example, is to at least put one of those utility bills in your own name, because those are often reported and is, you know, and then of course make sure it gets paid on time. is another big piece is to kind of get your name connected with a consistent and good payment history. That's really what it's all about.
Alex.
Yeah, we had a child of a client come in the other day. The young man is about 22, and we were talking about financial planning. He said, "Well, I'm getting ready to buy a truck, and I've saved up enough money for cash to buy the truck." And I suggested that he go to a bank and pay most of it with cash, but get a little bit of a credit with a bank. And that's an installment loan as opposed to a revolving credit like at a department store. But instead of thinking only, you know, about paying everything with cash, because he has no credit history.
Yeah, start building a history.
Start building it.
You know, one interesting thing I'm just thinking about is 20 years ago, the conversation would have been, well, what about the stay-at-home mom? But there's so few stay-at-home moms anymore. But, you know, there's a big issue that women weren't building up their credit score because everything was in the husband's name. And then if they split up or something, the wife had no credit. You don't see that being talked about nearly as much anymore.
But however, if you are in that situation, what do you recommend?
You should make sure some things get put in your name, you know, whether it's the utility bills or some of the charges, you know, it should be put in your name so that you are building up a history.
Now, are there So are there things that you can do once you start getting a little bit of credit? Are there things that you can do to prevent your credit from going bad again? For example, I hear that even if a credit card company offers you, like the other day, Home Depot offered me $15,000 in a credit line. And I went back and said, you know, I don't want $15,000. Is that the right move? Because when you get these huge credit lines out there, once your credit is rebuilt, that can be a problem too as well, right?
It can be. It is a factor in the FICO score, and this is a common question we get because it's, you know, on one hand it's like, you want to have the ratios look good. On the other hand, you don't want to have a whole bunch of cards out there, and so when David says it's a very specific to your situation, I think it is. But I think the rule of thumb would be is, you know, get a reasonable extension of credit, but you don't need the $15,000. Maybe $8,000 would be good enough for you. And assuming you don't have, you know, 25 cards from 25 different stores, you know, you're probably going to be fine. So, you know, making sure that you're being responsible and I would commend you for just, you know, kind of engaging and thinking about, you know, what makes sense for me, not just to get what I want at Home Depot, but for my overall situation and credit score.
And while we're on that topic, I just want to give our listeners a warning because there are a lot of those zero interest offers out there, say zero interest for 24 months or 18 months, what have you. But if you don't get that bill paid off in that time frame, the interest does apply and it's accrued from day one. So you can get hit with a really big surprise if you don't get that paid off on time.
Well, I want to thank our guests on the Cash Money Crew. That's Lucas Butchell from KHC Wealth Management and David Jackson from Waddell & Reed, as well as Alex Petrovic from Petrovic Incorporated. They represent our local Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow as we look at the death penalty developments and have a conversation with Chris Kobach on voter ID. Up to Date is next with a conversation about college decisions. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Ross Steinmetz. I'm Susan Wilson. This is KCUR. Keep listening.